Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Friday, May the 12th. Today, we're going to be chatting with our good friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to be talking about a couple of very important topics. The first one is Trump and the director Comey, the firing of the director, also the reaction by the media. I think we pretty much expected the reaction by the Democrats. I mean, they were all ready to fire Comey, and then all of a sudden they criticized President Trump for firing Comey. So I think the Democrats have become extremely predictable. Sadly, so has the media. I think some of the reaction has been a bit of an overreaction. You know, the constitutional crisis and Watergate and the Saturday Night Massacre. I think it's a little bit too much. But nevertheless, I think the White House better get ready for it because this is the way it's going to be. There's also Obamacare, which now left the House, is on its way to the Senate, and President Trump said today that there's going to be a plan by the end of August. That's pretty optimistic to me, but we'll see what happens. In the second segment, we'll be looking at 2018. As many of our listeners know, this is something we've done with Barry many times over the last few years. We've looked ahead to elections and done some analysis of upcoming elections. Of course, it's very premature, as Barry himself said in the article that he wrote over at the Prairie Editor. But we have a couple of ideas today. Barry wrote a very interesting article about the three different options, three different scenarios that you could see in 2018. So we're going to get into all of that with our good friend Barry. Hello, Barry. How are you? You must be very happy that the Yankees are winning.
Well, I wish they were. I mean, they did very well until a few days ago. They've lost three in a row, and I think they're going to lose again tonight, playing one of your Texas teams that's doing very well, and but there's a long, as you have always pointed out, Silvio, it's the season is very long, 162 games.
That's right. It's a long season.
We're only at 20%, I think.
That's right. About 30 or so games. There's a long way to go. There's a long way to go, but it's always fun to win, particularly when you have a young team like the Rangers, the Yankees, as well as the Astros. That's another very good young team, too. So it's fun to be in a city with a young team, and when that team starts winning, as the Yankees have done in New York. Let's look at, in our first segment, I wanted to talk about the firing of Director Comey. As far as I'm concerned, it was an easy call on Director Comey. I wish he had done it before. I wish President Trump had done this on day one of his presidency. It would not have been controversial if he'd done it so. But he did it now, of course, and it's become very controversial. So, first of all, let's talk about the decision itself. Barry, did you support the decision to fire the director?
Well, of course. I mean, it made a great deal of sense. Now, I like Comey. And let's be honest, without Comey, we probably don't have President Trump. I think Comey's intervention, and I think he intervened he made a decision that was, he didn't try and alter the election, but he had to know that it would have impact. But it certainly changed the momentum at a critical moment. And it changed the momentum earlier, when he canceled the investigation. So when he revived it, it really didn't help Mrs. Clinton at all. Nonetheless, and I think Comey, for the most part, has been a good steward of the FBI. The problem is he had just become too hot to handle. He had gone so public and was involved in so many controversies that it was very hard to maintain the high standards of the FBI wants to reach. And I think that the president kept him on for a while, but then he could see that he was just going to go from one controversy to the next. And that's not what the job of the head of the FBI is. Now, J. Edgar Hoover used to do that, and most presidents were afraid to fire him, and nobody ever did. As somebody pointed out, Donald Trump's afraid of nobody, and he just went ahead and fired him. I think he made the right decision. It doesn't mean that Comey is not a good man or wasn't a good FBI director, but it does mean that his situation had become untenable. And I think the president did the only thing that he reasonably could do. And the controversy is so ridiculous because what did we hear for weeks?
Right.
One Democrat after the other, including
right.
We want him fired. We want, right. In fact, even one prominent Democrat said, if Hillary had fired Comey, I would have loved it. But so obviously, it's all about Trump. It's all about the attempt to delegitimize him and put him on the spot. It had nothing to do with the firing. Every Democrat wanted it as much as any Republican. So and there's just no question that Comey had become just too hot to handle for an FBI director. I mean, you have to have a certain discretion.
Right.
I think Comey had actually gotten to like being in the news as much as he became, and I think he lost his sense of perspective to a degree.
Right.
But I don't think it really is that he got fired because he wasn't a good FBI director. He got fired because his situation had become untenable for the new president.
I think so, and I think he had become. It's almost like I mentioned to a friend. It's like going to a baseball game, and the only thing you talk about after the game is the umpire. But that's not what you're supposed to be talking about. The umpire is supposed to be quietly making calls. But if the umpire is the issue, then something's wrong. And I think that's what happened with Director Comey. I agree with you. I think he's basically a good guy. But he let this thing get away from him when he had that press conference for Mrs. Clinton last July, when I remember listening to it on the radio, Barry, as I'm sure a lot of people did. And I was listening to him and saying to myself, this lady is going to jail for 50 years because of the way he outlined all of her problems and then saying, no, we're not going to prosecute her. I think that was a huge mistake for the director to do that. He should have gone to the attorney general and said, look, this is my recommendation. You take it from here because I'm not supposed to give a speech like that and talk about a case like that, Barry.
Well, I think I didn't have so much of a problem. I mean, I realized the speech implied all along that he was going to prosecute. I think he was in an impossible position himself. He couldn't. So what he did was he made it very clear that although he wasn't going to go forward, he thought she was guilty, or he thought she was indictable. And if not guilty, he can't make that judgment, but certainly indictable. And that left that impression. He was never very good to Mrs. Clinton. If we ever got a chance to get to speak to him off the record, I think we would find that he thought she had probably done some things that were wrong. But the fact is, he's, after all, the FBI director works for the attorney general, specifically for the deputy attorney general, and not directly for the president, although the president can hire and fire him. But in the end, a good FBI director is low profile, a good manager, and a man of solid integrity. And you have to have all of those qualities, not just one of them or two of them.
That's right.
And that's why it's going to be very difficult for Mr. Trump to replace him, because he'll need to find somebody who isn't controversial. So far, when he's had to do that, he has done that. So I have confidence he'll find the right person. But it's got to be somebody the president feels confident in. And as far as, by the way, this stuff with Russia,
right?
With all the noise and all the things, there hasn't. I mean, I'm not saying there isn't something there, but so far we haven't got one iota of evidence that anything was done wrong. We've had some improper individuals who've done some improper things who were connected with the campaign, but never in regards to the campaign. So there's nothing so far. I'm not saying there isn't anything. I don't know. But so far, for considering all the publicity and all the theorizing, there's nothing there. Even the Democratic leaders, even Mrs. Feinstein, has admitted that. So it's all an attempt to delegitimize Donald Trump. It's all an attempt, a propaganda attempt, and I think the president probably felt a certain frustration that so much was being made about nothing.
That's right. Here's an interesting fact, Barry. Facebook, I don't think you're on Facebook, but Facebook,
no.
Yeah, you know what Facebook is, of course. Facebook is that social media. Millions of people are on Facebook. And one of the things that Facebook will do is keep track of the stories that people are talking about, the members of Facebook, the stories that they're exchanging and so on, the messages. And the story of Comey is not very high, meaning that at least in the world of Facebook, which is a pretty diversified world, I happen to be in it, that people are not really that into the Comey story. They're into a lot of other things, a lot of other stories, but the Comey story itself is not that interesting, which kind of leads me to my next point. I'm not saying that Facebook is a perfect measurement, but it is an indicator. It leads me to the point that I actually think that the reaction by the media about everything regarding this story, the constitutional crisis, you know, the comparisons to Watergate, the comparisons to the Saturday Night Massacre. I mean, that anybody who compares any of this to Watergate or the Saturday Night Massacre, Barry, is engaging in incredible ignorance. You probably know a heck of a lot more about it than I do. I've done a lot of reading about Watergate and the Saturday Night Massacre. I don't see any comparison here, Barry.
Well, I don't think it's ignorance. And maybe in some cases, I think it's actually deliberate. As I say, this is an attempt by people who don't like Donald Trump to try and delegitimize him, trying to make controversies with none exist, because they have nothing else. Because in reality, Donald Trump is actually doing quite a bit. That doesn't mean I agree with everything, because I don't. But I will say, considering he's only been in office a little more than 100 days, he's accomplished quite a bit, including naming a Supreme Court justice, including getting, finally, it took a while, got a few hiccups, to get the Obamacare repeal passed in the House. I think you alluded to it earlier. I think it will be passed. I think August is reasonable. It's going to be a different bill. The Senate has some different ideas, so it's going to have to be worked out. But I think the price to not give the bill to the president in the end, a bill, would be too high. I think the loss of face, the loss of confidence in the Republican Congress would be too great. And I think they would face some really serious, which we'll get to later, serious defeats in 2018. So I think too much at stake to not pass.
I agree with that. That
doesn't mean the bill's going to be ideal. There is no ideal bill.
Right.
Not considering the political realities. But there is a bill that's much, much better than Obamacare. That's already established. And then they can start to modify and fix the bill they finally do pass over time.
Right. Well, as you know that there are several companies. Aetna has decided to get out of Obamacare and other parts of the country. So, you know, when people are complaining, you hear some of these Congress people going home and getting these reactions at their town halls. You know, when you watch some of these things, you know, my reaction is these people who are demonstrating are, and I hate to say it, but they're either part of something or somebody telling them to show up, or they don't know what's going on, or no one has explained to them that the Republicans are not going to take away their Obamacare. What's going to take away their Obamacare is the marketplace, the reality that Obamacare is collapsing. I mean, Donald Trump likes to say that it's imploding, but he's exactly right. It is imploding. Just ask the people of Iowa. Ask the people of Kentucky, Tennessee. A lot of the people who live in rural areas, this is in really bad shape, Barry.
No question about it. If the Congress does nothing, Obamacare will more or less cease to exist in a year or so, even if they do nothing. And I think it's to the credit of the Republicans' leadership that rather than be irresponsible and simply let Obamacare die on the vine, they want to replace it with something that's workable and fair to as many people as possible. As I say, there's not going to be anything that's ideal. It ain't going to work. We don't live in that kind of world anymore. The perfect program doesn't exist. The perfect program may exist, but there's no way to pass it. In any legislature, any Congress, no matter
who
the party.
Not in this Washington. I mean, where you basically have Democrats in the House who were never going to play ball. They were simply never going to play ball. Now, I'll say one last thing before we take a break. I think when you go to the Senate, and this is part of what we'll talk about in the next segment, with as many Democrats running in what they call red states, I think you may see some of these Democrats be willing a little bit more to play ball, because whether it's, you know, North Dakota or Missouri or Montana or West Virginia or Indiana, these are states with significant rural populations where Obamacare is a problem. So these senators have a responsibility to their constituents to try to fix Obamacare and do something about it, because it's collapsing primarily in those states, Barry.
Right. And I think remember, the Republicans have a 52-48 margin. I think there's up to four, maybe even five senators who are waffling. At least one or two for sure are probably not going to vote for it. But they only need 50. They can afford to lose two because they have the vice president. And then you've got people like Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp, who, in fact, are probably going to vote for it because there's too much at stake in their states for them not to. So suddenly you have much more leeway. Now you have four votes. And what about the woman senator in Missouri and the one in Indiana? Suddenly you have six votes margin. So you can afford to lose a few moderate Republicans.
Well, Montana,
so
too.
I think
John,
it's
Tester
pass.
Up in, John Tester in Montana, too.
Yeah, well, there's actually four or five more. So there's
right.
Altogether there's 8 to 10 Democratic incumbent seats, if not incumbents themselves, who are vulnerable.
Right,
and
exactly.
They are very vulnerable.
That's exactly right. We're going to get into that in the next segment. So we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to discuss an article that Barry wrote in the last couple of days about 2018 and looking ahead to 2018 and some of the different scenarios of what could happen in 2018. So it's a fascinating piece that he wrote over at the Prairie Editor. We'll take a break and come right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. In the last segment, we were talking about the state of Mr. Trump and the director Comey and so on. Now we're going to move into 2018, which is the upcoming congressional midterm elections. And Barry, you wrote a fantastic piece over at Prairie Editor regarding the three different scenarios that we could have in 2018. Of course, you also said in your piece that this is all preliminary. It's still a long way to go. But I thought your three scenarios seemed pretty realistic to me as three possibilities. So give us just tell us what these three scenarios are and what could happen in the three of them, Barry.
Well, the three are that the first one is that Trump doesn't do well. The Congress fails to keep their promises. And the stock market and the economy are down. All bad news. This is what usually happens during the first 2 years of the first term of a president. And it usually means significant losses in the House. And in this case, it would probably reduce any big gains for the Republicans in the Senate. They'd probably still keep their majority. They possibly... It's humanly possible for them to lose their majority in the House. That's not likely, but it could happen under this circumstance. This would be worst case for the Republicans. Then the second scenario is one that I think is the most expected, the conventional wisdom, which is that it's not either a great success or a great failure. The president gets some things through and does not do others. The Congress is less than totally successful. The economy is stagnant. The stock market is not going up. In that case, the Republicans keep the House, but they lose some net seats, and the Republicans make gains of two or three or less in the Senate, and the Democrats have some real success in the governorships, since there are more Republicans up who are vulnerable than Democrats, you know, the reverse of the Senate situation, and they even pick up a few legislatures. So that would be the worst case for the that would be not a worst case, but a more, you know, probable case, a more neutral case. Now, the third choice is one that the media is not discussing, at least not what I call the meddling media or the liberal media. And that is that contrary to precedent and contrary to expectation, Donald Trump does pretty well, that the Congress gets some bills passed, tax reform, tax cuts. They get Obamacare repealed. They start working on education. The president is successful in his foreign policy. This is all speculative, and his popularity is up. And in this case, instead of the first-term blues for the president, which is what usually happens, Reagan, Carter, Clinton, even Obama, they've all been through that. Roosevelt had that problem. Didn't have that problem, but he had it. It came for him later. But the fact is that if that would happen now, Republicans could stay even or even pick up a few seats in the House. They could pick up anywhere from 6 to 10 seats in the Senate. They could keep most of their governorships and legislatures, and they would become pretty much a permanent majority. A semi-permanent. Nothing is permanent in American politics, but certainly for the foreseeable future. And that, of course, would also cinch the Supreme Court and federal district court judgeship and appeals court judgeships, and would probably lead to a much more conservative judiciary in the country, because it would probably indicate that Mr. Trump would have a very good chance to be reelected and would actually be president for 8 years. Now, that's the third choice. That's all speculative. None of it may happen. It may be a combination of some of these things, although I've pretty much outlined the various possibilities. We do have to remember that all the members of Congress are up. There are a number of people who are Republicans who are retiring or resigning to take cabinet posts and sub-cabinet posts. There will be Democratic resignations also. There are very few bright spots in the country for Republicans in the House. But interesting enough, one of the brightest is of all places right here in Minnesota, where the currently 5 Democrats and 3 Republicans hold incumbent seats. But at least one of those seats looks like the incumbent congressman has retired to run for governor, and that seat will almost certainly go Republican. It's in a conservative district.
Right.
A congressman from the other district, up in the 8th district, is very seriously thinking of running for governor. He doesn't. He's 73 years old. He doesn't want to serve again in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if that happens, that seat will go Republican. And then there's even another seat, the 7th district, where Colin Peterson, who's the most conservative member of the House, Democrats, if he could possibly lose. So you could pick up anywhere from 1 to 3 seats for the Republicans in one of the most blue states in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the exception that proves the rule. That
right.
is an exception.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that one of the points you made in the article that I thought was very interesting is that the Democrats are so down at the state legislatures right now, at the state governors as well. So they're going to make some gains, if only for no other reason than when parties govern, when you have a governor, governors have to make decisions, and sometimes they're unpopular, and sometimes, you know, that opens up the opportunity for the other party to win. So you could see some Democrat victories in some of the western states, for example, maybe some of the Midwestern states, or wherever it could be. There could be some Democrat victories, again, just because Republicans are human and not all of them are going to govern successfully. But when I look at some of the elections that we've had so far this year, well, the one in Georgia is still, that's still pending. But the one most interesting to me was the one not far from you in Omaha, Nebraska, where there was all kinds of talk about an election that the Democrats could win. This is for mayor of Omaha, I think. But the Democrats got in trouble over abortion because they ran a pro-life candidate, and many in their base did not want to support that candidate. And you remember the chairman of the Democrat Party, Mr. Perez, made the statement about pro-life and pro-choice. Democrats, the Democrats have a lot of problems coming together. I know they all hate Trump, but they don't necessarily know how to come together, Barry.
Well, both parties are divided, to be fair. But you're right. The Democratic Party it's not that it's so much divided. Well, it is becoming divided because, as you noticed, you know, the Bernie Sanders wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, the Maxine Waters wing is going to the left, just as the British Labour Party has been doing that. And, of course, as they've moved to the left in Great Britain, they've gone way, way down in popularity. In fact, it looks like there's going to be a landslide victory for the Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May and her party next month, because the Liberal Party, which it's not the Liberal Party, capital L, but the more liberal party, which is called the Labour Party, has moved to the left. And that's what's going on right now in the American Democratic Party, Big D. And but not all Democrats feel that way. There's still a movement which is a residue of the New Democratic the NDC, the New Democratic Coalition, out of which Bill Clinton came and was successful. And there were many moderate Democrats who did not go way off to the left, did not call for redistribution of the wealth, were not anti-business. And that's, as I see it, a sure loser for the Democrats. So they're divided. But I will say this, to be fair, if the Republicans do not fulfill their promises, at least in part, I mean, the president seems to be doing his part, albeit with his idiosyncrasies, but nevertheless, the substance of what he's doing seems to be fulfilling his promises. But so far, the Congress has not. And that's all. And next year is not a presidential year. It's a midterm congressional year, as well as governors and state legislatures. And so you have to have the party in power, which now they have all three branches of government, and they are expected to fulfill their promises, or most of them. And if they don't, if it's more stalemate, then the country will rightfully turn back to the Democrats for leadership.
Right.
So,
or at the very least, Barry, what you'll see, I think you're exactly right. If the Republicans do not come through, you're exactly right. I think what will also happen is if many of these Republicans in the House are going to get primaries if they do not come through. So there's going to be a lot of division within the Republican Party in that respect, as happened in, I think it was 2014, when Representative Eric Cantor was defeated in the primaries. I mean, I think you may see a lot of that if the party doesn't come through. But I actually do believe they're gonna finish the job with Obamacare. And if they can explain it a little bit better to the public, so far they really haven't. But if they can explain it to the public that we're not taking anything away from you, because whatever you have of Obamacare is simply falling apart. Let me give you an example, Barry, of Obamacare. This is a real-life example. There's a young man who I know has a wife expecting a young child as well, a young boy and a wife expecting. And he's a software technical guy, and we've been talking about some things related to software. And we started talking about Obamacare, and he explained to me about his situation. Here's a young man, mid-20s, 20-something. As I say, his wife is expecting a baby. They have a small child as well. He said to me his premium for Obamacare is $1,500 a month, with a deductible, I think he either said $15,000 or $18,000. So he was telling me, I'm going to be paying just more for my insurance premium than my home, and that $18,000 premium simply gives me the opportunity to get into this deductible. So, I mean, it is really bad news when it comes to Obamacare, and the more you talk to real people, like I did this week with this friend of mine, when you begin to realize how bad things are, Barry.
Well, I didn't know that particular example. There are many other stories. There are a few people who seem to be satisfied, but they seem to be the minority. And, of course, Obamacare never fulfilled its promise to take care of everybody. Still millions of people without any insurance. So that didn't solve that problem. There were a couple of good things about Obamacare, such as portability and but the fact of the matter is that it was a failure. It was a failure from the day it was enacted and signed. It was a failure in its proposal. And remember, it was thousands of pages that nobody read. I mean, it's exactly the wrong way to do legislation. But the problem is, it's like somebody wants a holy grail here. You want the perfect plan that isn't going to cost much and give you a lot of service. That isn't going to happen. It's not possible. So there's going to have to be trade-offs. If you want to pay a low premium, you're going to have high deductibles. If you want to have, pre-existing conditions, you're going to have caps. It has to be. There's no other way. It's part of
right.
the reality of our times.
Well,
and,
it's the actuarial
the
reality of it.
The
yeah.
politicians, and besides, it's always, what is this health? It's insurance. What is insurance? Insurance is, it doesn't mean you're going to use it. It means that you're protected in the case of catastrophe. It's an insurance program. It isn't health care. It isn't health care. And health care is something else. And
mm-hmm.
we've got a crisis in health care. That has nothing to do with Obamacare or health insurance. It has to do with the practice of medicine, the
mm-hmm.
availability of physicians, and the paperwork, and the rules and regulations, and things which are making the practice. I'm a doctor's son, and the practice
mm-hmm.
of he was a physician for 65 years. He was practiced
mm-hmm.
medicine until he was 92. That's
mm-hmm.
those kind of old-fashioned
right.
doctors don't exist anymore. There's no one. My current physician has just informed me at the age of 62 he's retiring. I don't blame him. I don't hold it against him. But 62 and he's retiring because there's just too much you have to fill out, too many forms. I mean, your practice of medicine is primarily filling out forms.
Exactly.
And you have no time to spend with your patients.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance, this is like the fourth physician who's retired on me in the last 6 years. As soon as I finally find a good physician, he retires.
And the shame of that is that you're taking somebody, I mean, when you're 62 years old as a doctor, I mean, unless you're in bad health, you're in exactly the perfect age to be a doctor because, you know, experience matters a great deal in that profession.
Sure.
But we're also driving a lot of them out of business or out of the profession by these idiotic premiums for liability and stuff like that. At least here in Texas, we took some steps to limit that when President Bush was governor back in the late 90s, and it's not as bad here as it is in other states, but you're right. I mean, there's a lot more to deal with here than just Obamacare or insurance. We should be doing a better job, for example, with prevention. We should be doing a better job with lots of things. But the big issue, of course, is Obamacare, and that has to be fixed. It's never going to be fixed to the satisfaction of the House Democrats. But frankly, the House Democrats don't really matter. They're going to be a loud minority, and that's all they're going to be. Well, Barry, we had a great show today. I want to thank you for your time, as always. You wrote a couple of other things at the Prairie Editor this week that we would like the listeners to go to. You wrote a very interesting article about the parties, the election in France, and one about a word from the Portuguese language. Take a minute and just mention that, Barry. I thought that was a really neat article. It's your last one on the Prairie Editors. Just take a minute and talk about that.
Well, before I was a journalist, I was and am a published poet, a literary person, and a lover of music. And as I point out, every language has words that can't be translated. And the Portuguese language, which is a beautiful language, now I happen to speak, my second language is Spanish, and I love Spanish, it's a great language, but Portuguese is a different language. Now, they were both developed side by side on the same Iberian Peninsula, but they developed differently. And Portuguese came up with, and the Portuguese have a kind of a culture and sensibility historically that produces in their language certain words which don't exist in other languages. And this particular word is called saudade. And there is really no English translation. it's a sort of a nostalgia, a melancholy, a longing for things which are which can never be come back, can never be retrieved. It's a very it's has a certain sadness to it. It fits into the music and literature and the character of the Portuguese psyche. But, as I point out, even we in the north here, now you come from Cuba, and so you have also a Iberian culture, so you can understand saudade, but for those people up here who are Scandinavian, Teutonic, Nordic, English, Anglo-Saxon, where they have less emotion in their language, the word saudade is not translatable. On the other hand, I point out that we live in a time when so much change is happening, the velocity of technological change is so fast, that even northern types are feeling this feeling of saudade, especially older people. I point out that younger people probably have no idea. So anyone who's like 30 or 25 reading my article say, what's he talking about? Because they're used to this constant change, this technology, smartphones, social media, internet, computers. I mean, but those of us who are older, we didn't grow up with all that. And we remember the way it was. And it isn't just nostalgia. That's typical. Everybody has nostalgia in every culture. But this is a new kind of saudade, because it's about something which we can never go back to.
Right. It's and sort so, of like, yeah, go ahead, because I wanted to
I don't
give
know
an
if
example.
You're much more fluent in Spanish. I don't know if the Spanish have a word for it.
I can't think of a Spanish word for it. Suavecito might be the closest thing. That's the one that came to my mind. Suavecito is more of a Cuban expression, more of a Caribbean expression. And suavecito means just taking it easy, kind of. That's kind of what it means, suave.
Well, this,
word
is,
suave.
This is quite different. This
no,
has
I know,
a kind
I understand.
Of a,
yeah.
It has a
no,
kind
I
of and of course, the bossa nova and the
right.
samba, the music, they have very.
Right. No, but
they,
what I think.
So
what
they
I
have.
Think you're,
they have. It's a natural. So you can sense it if you know that music. You can feel.
Right.
Because it's again. It's not rational.
Right. Well, here's my sense, and I think just to wrap it up by saying this, I think many of us. I think many of us over, let's say, over 45, I'll put it that way, remember a time when you could, if you wanted to talk to somebody, you had to get together with them, you know, and talk to them face to face. And I think that today, of course, a lot of things are done by text or whatever. And I think that's kind of, you know, the article that you wrote kind of reminded me of that time when, you know, let's say, when you wanted to get together with a friend and you would say, hey, let's meet at the cafe, and you didn't have a text to send them, I'm on my way, you didn't have a phone with you or anything like that. I mean, it was just everything was just that way. And sometimes I miss that, because sometimes I think we have too much technology, too much information, too much texting, way too many things, and I think to some extent some of the problems with the 24/7 news cycle, you know, the cable news, 24/7 news cycle, a lot of it is a curse, I think, because it means that you have to be constantly putting out news. But Barry, I want to thank you as always for joining us, and we'll do it again. We'll do it again in a little bit. Happy Memorial Day to you, and we'll do it again.
Well, good luck to the Rangers.
That's right. Well, we need it. We need it tonight. We need it tonight because the Astros won. We need to win tonight, but we're losing 2-1 in the eighth. So we need a comeback. So pray for one.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor, fantastic friend of our show, fantastic website, of which I'm a subscriber, and I would encourage all of you to be subscribers. You're going to get a tremendous amount of information. You're going to learn a great deal from getting his posts, his information. It's just valuable. And he goes off on different topics, which is what I love about him, as he did with this Portuguese word. Have a wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.